God did provide. As my friend Samuel Clemens said, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plan. I presume that God is laughing at us because he certainly got my plan to be here on the 4th. This is also tied in Mount McGregor, New York, in the summer of 1885. Writing my memoir and dying. But here I am. And it's a life that I never would have expected. I couldn't have planned it the way it turned out. I was born in Point Pleasant, Ohio, April 27, 1922. I was about, the town was about two stone throws from the Ohio River. But my family moved to Georgetown, Ohio, shortly after I was born. And that's really the town that I remember growing up in. My father ran a leather tanning business. And I don't know if any of you in the leather tanning business, but they say that you can, when you meet a tanner, you can always tell his occupation, no matter how many times he's bathed. And I can attest to the fact that Tim is dirty, hot, heavy, smelly, and bloody work. I worked for my father, but I was not surprised that my parents sent me to school almost the entire time I was growing up in Georgetown. But I have to say that my real love, then and throughout my life, of course, once when I was about 2 years old, the neighbor came running into my parents' house, rapped on the front door, and screamed, "When Ulysses is out, he's sitting under a horse out in the front yard." And my mother, who was always a very taciturn lady, looked out the front door and said, "Ulysses and horses understand each other." And we did. By the time I was 10 years old, I was running freight and passengers with a team of horses from Georgetown to Cincinnati. I guess I traveled as far as Toledo and Louisville. I went to Cleveland, Virginia, way down into Bourbon County, Kentucky. We couldn't make the trip to Toledo in one day, but I would make it to Toledo, and then after discharging the passengers, I would spend the night there by myself and come back in the next couple of days. I always loved horses. In fact, coming back from Toledo on that trip, I saw a horse. I never owned my own horse. I'd always used my father's. So I talked to the farmer, and he said he wanted $25 for the horse. I'd never bought one before, so I went to my father, and I said, "What should I do?" And my father said, "Well, what you do is go back to him and tell him to give him $20 for the horse. And if you won't take that, tell him to give him $22.50 for the horse." And then he won't take that, give him $25. So I went back to the gentleman and I said, "Talk to my father, he says I should offer you $20 for the horse. And if you won't take that, then I should offer you $22.50. So I guess you don't want to pay for the horse. One day my father came home and told me that he believed I was going to go to the military academy at West Point. I told him I didn't want to go to the military academy at West Point, and he said that if he believed I was going to the academy at West Point, then I believed I was going to the academy at West Point, and in fact, that's what happened. My appointment came about in a rather unusual way. The Bailey boy who lived up the hill from us had gone to West Point, but had failed. And was embarrassed about coming home. My father lived from his father that he had failed West Point, and my father went to our congressman, Congressman Hamer, and asked him to give me the appointment. You need to know my father, because he and Congressman Hamer used to be very close friends, but hadn't spoken for 15 years. They had a falling out over politics. You know, my father, that would not be unusual, but they had a falling out over politics. I can't imagine what it took for my father to go to Congressman Hamer and ask him to appoint me to the military academy. did. And I started off and my dad took me down to the front river, the bank of the river where I was born. First part of my dad's steamboat headed up the Ohio River. And I got on. I was 17 years old. I was 5'1", with 117 pounds. I had a valise with my initials on it. And I have to explain to you now that my initials have always been problems. I mean, I was born and given the name Hired Ulysses Grant. Everybody always called me Ulysses, but my name was Hiram Ulysses Grant. And my initials on that report kind of so spelled pardon. And okay, of course, but that was technically my name. Didn't really bother me when I was in Georgetown because everybody knew me, Ulysses or whatever. The one good thing about going to the military academy was I got to travel. I told you I'd been as far east as Wheeling, but I wanted to see big cities. So the steamboat went as far as Pittsburgh. I got on the Pennsylvania Canal and got partway across the state. I got on the train, a railroad train, that went 18 miles an hour, the fastest I ever got it. And went to Philadelphia. When I got to Philadelphia, there's no way to get to the military academy. So I explored Philadelphia for several days. Finally went to New York City. Explored New York City and realized that I could no longer stretch the time I needed to be at West Point. And I went up past the river, got off the steamboat, walked up the hill to the registrar. And I said, I am Cadet Grant from West Point, or from Ohio. He said, what's your full name? And I said, it's Ulysses Grant. He said, we don't have a Ulysses Grant, we have Hiram Ulysses Grant. I said, well, yes, but I don't know why Hiram. He said, if you're going to the United States Military Academy, your name is Hiram Ulysses Grant. Actually, I know that story. It enlisted me as Ulysses S. Grant. But the comment was when he appointed me, my middle name was probably Pearson, which is my mother's maiden name. So that thing worked out. I got the registrar, I went to Ulysses Grant. But your name is now Ulysses Simpson Grant, or U.S. Grant, which I immediately, as everyone does at the academy, got a nickname. Because in the U.S., I was known as Uncle Sam or Sam Grant. And among my classmates, that's the name that I always was known by. Military life had no charm for me, and I had no fantasies at all about having a military career. If I should happen to succeed in graduating from the military academy, which I did not expect to do. In fact, the first year I was there, there was a bill before Congress to abolish the military academy. And I had hoped that they would pass the bill, because then I could go home without the stigma of having failed. I studied, didn't study very hard. I enjoyed reading, always enjoyed reading at the academy. And eventually, I graduated. Not at the top, not at the bottom of my class, but in the middle, 1937, 1939. I was immediately assigned to the 4th Infantry because I had expressed my continuous love of horses. I had applied to be in the Dragoons, which later became known as the Cavalry. In fact, the last week of our 4th year at the Academy, they had a horse jumping contest. And they had a particularly practiced horse that no one had jumped at all before. And I managed to jump that horse 6.5 feet. The record is stood at the academy. Well, as of 1885, it's still there. I'm very proud of that. But it didn't get me any dragoons. It got me in the 4th Infantry, and I was assigned to Jefferson Barracks, right outside St. Louis. My roommate from school, Fred Dent, was also assigned with me as a roommate at Jefferson Barracks. It happened that Fred's parents family lived only about 6 miles from Jeffersonville, which was a great benefit on weekends. And we could, whenever we had leave, we could go there and have a home cooked meal. I would avoid Fred Conwell's often saying that he and I didn't get along as far as politics were concerned. Fancied himself a colonel. I always called himself Colonel then, and never served in the military, but he fancied himself a Southern gentleman. Had what he thought was a plantation home. Called it Whitehaven because, of course, the house has to have a name if it's a plantation. It's pretty green, but he called it Whitehaven nonetheless. One day, Phil's sister came home from finishing school in St. Louis. And we talked, and she enjoyed writing. She enjoyed sitting and talking. She enjoyed reading. She enjoyed all the things that I enjoyed. And Julie and I would sit on the front porch of her daughter's house many evenings. Julia had a seriously cross left eye. Very cross, and it's very difficult for Julia to read. But she would spend hours feeling joyous when I would read to her. And shortly, and about the time that we received word that we were going to be deployed to Mexico, Julia and I agreed that we would be married when I came back. We were given pastoral parents, and it was a secret engagement at that point. So we had both agreed that we would be married when we got back. And I got that. Because the Mexican War was about to start. It was about to be provoked by the United States. I think it was a wicked war. It was fought for political purposes, and there is, for me, no justification for the fighting of the Mexican War. But I was a military officer, and it was my job to go and serve my country. I was a second lieutenant. I was assigned as a quartermaster, and we went to first down in the Louisiana camp there, finally went down to the Rio Grande, which was a provocative act in itself, and eventually found ourselves fighting in the Battle of Monterrey, one of the first major battles of the war. At one point during the battle, we were our unit was in the middle of town. We were running out of ammunition. Our town was a laid out in squares with small adobe huts, and somebody had to go get ammunition, and I volunteered to go. Unfortunately, we were under fire at every street corner. There were enemies, there was the enemy that was shooting at me. It was necessary for me to ride on the side of my horse, so I threw one leg up over the saddle and grabbed onto the neck of the horse and hung onto the side of the horse and was able to avoid being shot as I made it out of town. It was actually a fence near the end of the town. I had a jump while I was on the side of the horse. It was a good horse. We made it out, and we got the ammunition back to the unit. And then my commanding officer asked me why the quartermaster. I was in the middle of fighting because I wasn't supposed to be there. I was supposed to be behind the line sending implements that were and things that were necessary when the war, so when the battle was going on. That seemed to be a problem because I think I'm the only officer in the United States Army that saw action in every battle during the Mexican War. The war was fought in two parts. The first part of the war was fought in northern Mexico, just over the Rio Grande River. And after we were then under the command of General Zachary Taylor, old rough and ready, I have to admit that watching General Taylor in the field was very important to me. Because General Taylor didn't wear a uniform at all. Sometimes he wore a big straw hat and maybe not even a jacket, just the left of his hand. But he could command men by the force of his personality. And he knew everything that was going on a battlefield. He was constantly aware of what was happening everywhere on the battlefield. After the northern part of the war was fought, then it was time to invade the city of Mexico. And in order to do that, had the land on the west coast, on the east coast of Mexico, near Veracruz, and marched inland. And I was one of the officers that was assigned to that part of the battle of Europe. In that part of the battle, we were under General Winfield Scott, old Captain Frederick. And he was at the opposite of General Taylor, as you can imagine. Old Captain Frederick wore every possible brogue and decoration on his uniform that he could possibly wear. He was an enormous man. He was well over 6 feet tall and weighed 300 pounds. I saw him once when I was a cadet at the military, and I thought that at the military academy, and I thought there was no grander soldier in the world. He impressed me as a cadet. He impressed me less so once I was a professional soldier and in the field under General Scott. But he was nonetheless the commander that was responsible for taking the city of Mexico, marching inland, fighting the battles that were necessary to finally end the war. One of his aides was a captain, Robert T. Lee, who was a legend in the military academy. I met General Lee. I met Captain Lee in the field. I was with a battery, an artillery battery, and we were shooting taking target practice. And Captain Lee came to us and reviewed what we were doing, offered some suggestions. And that was the opportunity that I had to meet Captain Lee before April of 1865. Finally, the war ended, and I went back to St. Louis. Still in the 4th Infantry, and at that time, with a little coaching, Colonel Dent allowed me to marry Julia. We were married, and we were very happy. I was moved around by the Army. I was at Fort Drum in northern New York, in Fort Detroit in Michigan, and the winters were very cold, but nonetheless, it was pleasant duty. Julia was there, soon our first son fell before, we soon found that she was with our, she was carrying our second child, and then that I was assigned to go to the West Coast. The 4th Infantry was sent to the West Coast, then because of her delicate condition, we said it was a good idea that she not travel, especially not travel with Fred, who was only about 2 years old at the time, plus one on the way. So Julia stayed. She went to St. Louis for a while with her parents, but it was my job as quartermaster to get the 4th Army and their dependents from New York City to the West Coast. The trip was ill-fated to begin with. We got to New York City, and the steam ships that had been secured and reserved for the Army had all of the souls, the civilians, which meant that the 700 of us that were making the trip had to sleep on the deck from New York City to the Isthmus of Panama and Colombia. Once we got to Colombia, to the Isthmus, things got worse. At that point, I believe someday there will be a canal there. At this point, we could travel partway by rail, partway by river, but we were surrounded by mosquitoes, we were surrounded by brackish water, we were surrounded by unsanitary conditions that soon led to widespread cholera. In fact, by the time we made it past through the Isthmus, we had lost 100 of the 700 people, left them barely there, including all of the children under 5. So then you doubly glad I hadn't really want to come with me. I met a Lieutenant Slaughter, who recently graduated from the military academy. So he's an officer there. And he was there with us, but he explained that he'd been in New York City, he'd been ordered to San Francisco, and brother was making the passage across town. He sailed down around the southern tip of South America.
That's 7 months.
Now, the thing I have to understand is that the dense water has to
definitely see that.
I think that the waving of a diamond cloth would make him seasick. So he would hear the fifth of the entire voice
7 months around
Cape Horn. They got to take little, they got to San Francisco, and he was told by the army that he wasn't supposed to be there when he'd be in New York City. So he said that in New York City. And when he got to New York City, they told him, no, you are supposed to be in San Francisco. And he told him, with the mind, he said, I wish I'd listened to my father. He told me to join the Navy. And if I had, I would have done nearly as much saying as I did on the soldier. The time he arrived on the West Coast, and he went to Fort Vancouver, which is at the mouth of the Columbia River. At the time, I thought it was the most dismal and dreary place I had ever seen. It rained constantly, it was always foggy and cold, and particularly unpleasant. And probably worst of all, for a soldier, there was nothing to do. The Indians were too sad. One of the men I served with was a native graduate of military academy, George Pickett, and presented Pickett translated the Bible into one of the Indian languages of the Indians there in the Northwest, just because he didn't have anything else to do. Eventually, he was saying that I was proven wrong. There was a more desolate place in Fort Vancouver, and that was Fort Humboldt in Northern California, near the town of Eureka, north of San Francisco. Not only was there no activity at all, but the only thing officers did at that point was play cards and
drink.
Like it or not, that was all there was to do in the old army, and there was really no stigma about drinking alcohol, unless you couldn't hold your alcohol, and I will readily confess that I cannot hold my liquor. One of my officer comrades said one time that three fingers of bourbon will put the liquids under the table. One sip, two sips, and I start to slur my teeth, and more than that, and I can't hold my liquor. It also was a problem to compound it by Colonel Montgomery, who was my commanding officer, who was a martinet, if I ever saw one, and he was constantly hounding me. And I didn't know what to do. Getting letters from Julio was almost never happened. It went months, several months. In fact, for the first year and a half, I didn't even know about a second child. Whether it was a boy or a girl, or what age, anyway. But I didn't know that at the time. And here was. A mail coming this evening, but brought me no news from you, nor nothing in reply to my application for orders to go home. I can't conceive of the cause of the delay. The state is sent by me is scarcely bearable. I think I've been away from my family quite long enough, and sometimes I feel as though I could just go home without leave. I didn't do that. I wasn't going to do that, but I was seriously considering resigning from the army. One day, a pay call was my job to hand out pay the money to the soldiers as they lined up, and the colonel accused me of having been drinking. I probably had been drinking the night before, but he told me that I could either resign or he would have me court-martialed. March 6th, Fort Humboldt, California, of your wife. I've only had one letter from you in 3 months, and that is a long time on the way, so you may know how anxious I am to hear from you. I sometimes get so tempted to resign and trust in Providence and my own exertion. They're living where I can have you and them with me. Whenever I get to one subject, however. Poverty. Poverty begins to stare me in the face. And then I think of what I would do is doing our little ones to death and necessity of life. It finally became unbearable, and on the day that I was finally appointed captain, second lawyer, I think the third member of my class, 1843, to be a finally came on. I had the effect of tender my left, the resignation of my commission as an officer of the Army, and the test of the prepared to take effect on the 31st of July. I am so very respectful, the obedient spirit. Yes, yes.
Being a clerk than I was being a rent collector. Nonetheless, I
was able to do that, provide for the family. As a lawyer, a younger lawyer, with very little business across the street, he used to come to the store and like to hear my stories about the Mexican War and the Army days. And then April of 1961 came about, Fort Sumter was fired on, and war fever swept the country. I have to admit that once you served in a war, you were somewhat inoculated from war fever. But nonetheless, I agreed to attend and preside at the meeting that was run by this young warrior. There, every town in the north wanted to raise a company of soldiers to send off to the war, and the leader was no different. The young John Rollins would get up and talk to people about all the wonders and glories of war and how we had to get to Springfield because the war was going to be over if we didn't hurry up. Seeing the boys that volunteer, I knew that they needed somebody to go with them, and I would take them to Springfield so we could get them signed up properly. Then we took them down there and realized that my country had educated me to be a soldier and pay for my education. It was my responsibility that this, once the war had started, my responsibility. I was a native son of Ohio, that was where I would like to serve. I went back there, talked to the head of the volunteers for Ohio, George McClellan, and the old army was a small place, and stories and reputation spread quickly. And by the time I got to General McClellan's office, I had to take a seat, and I sat there for 2 days and didn't see me. So I came back. Eventually received a commission as a colonel in the 21st Illinois Regiment. Mainly I was filling out papers at that time for the governor, but I was also a colonel, and eventually my congressman from Galena secured for me a brigadier general's commission, and I was commissioned as a brigadier general, and it was that big, so I was actually a general before I was a colonel, if you know how that works in the Army. I was assigned to Missouri in the first year of the war, and saw my first action in leading troops in war. First battle was in Florida, it was outside Florida, Missouri, and the Confederates were camped over the ridge of a hill, and I was leading my men up over the hill. As we walked up that side of the hill, and you could still see the smoke rising on the other side from their campfire. I felt my heart pounding in my chest, and it slowly rose until it seized my throat. I didn't think I could even talk as we got to the top of the hill. We looked out over the hill, and the Confederates had run away. And I realized at that point that they were as afraid of me as I was of them. And for whatever reason, whether you can understand my logic or not, from that point on, I never feared the enemy. I always understood that we were fighting on equal footing, and I felt that it was my job to take the fight to him. Followed the Battle of Belmont, Missouri, down on the river, he took steamboats down the ironclads down the river, got off, very much the same situation. We came out along the Confederate camp, and they had retreated. They retreated actually across the river to Kentucky, Columbus, Kentucky. And my men started looting. All the tents were there, all of the men's kit was there, and they started looting, and they were having a great time and really out of my control. And in the meantime, the Confederates came back across the river, rearmed, and with more men, and they were between us
and the ships became narrow. We had to fight our way back to the ship, which we did, but it was not exactly a glorious victory for the United States Army that day, as I had obtained a horse, actually from another officer, and was the last one off dry land onto the boat, and it's a very steep bank down the river, down to the river, and there had been a landing, there had been a board to walk across, but they pulled that board up by the time I got there. And so my horse sized up the situation and sat down on the bank of the river, and we slid down the river on the horse, and when we got to the bottom, the horse stepped up onto the boat, and we got onto the boat. I went into the captain's cabin to rest for a few minutes. I lay down. I've already been prone to very severe headache. I had one that day, and I lay down on the pillow, and I suddenly sat up. And I'm not sure why I sat up, but as I sat up, a bullet came to the side of the ship and hit the pillow where my head was in. So it was a very close call. I never told Julia about that, and that was one that she didn't need to know about. As the career went on, as the war went on, my next job became to attack the two forts on the Columbia, on the Tennessee and the Cumberland River, Fort Stanley and Donovan. As we moved up the rivers, much in the same way that we had done in Belmont, but we learned a few things about using amphibious assault. But we managed to take those two forts, move down the Tennessee River to Pittsburgh Landing, and the Battle of Shiloh was fought. Battle of Shiloh was where I realized that the war was not going to be a short war. Up until that point, April of 62, there hadn't been many big battles. A lot of long skirmishes, a lot of battles, like the ones that I fought in Missouri. But on that day, I came across an open field on the second day of the battle, over which the Confederates had charged several times the day before. And it was possible to walk in any direction on that field without your foot ever touching the ground, stepping only on body. And it was at that point that anything that we had done in the Mexican War, the biggest battles in the Mexican War might not have even warranted a report by the time the War of Rebellion had reached the stage of Shiloh. After Shiloh, I was immediately removed from command by General Halleck. General Halleck was a brilliant man. I really don't harbor a grudge against him, but there was a terrible misunderstanding as far as communication was concerned. General Halleck took over and marched the army boldly 30 miles from Pittsburgh Landing to Corinth, Mississippi. And it only took him 30 days to march those 30 miles. And by the time he got there, whether it was boredom or the enemy had just decided to move on, the Corinth was no longer occupied by the enemy by the time he got there. I regained my command, and we fought the battles that I had become better known for in starting late 62 and into July of 63, we managed to take Vicksburg. At that point, the army had become trapped in Chattanooga. They asked me to go to Chattanooga to try to break the siege there. Oh, I guess I should tell you about the surrender of Fort Donelson. There were two very incompetent generals at Fort Donelson. And I knew that those generals would not be able to hold the fort. They managed to sneak out of the fort, and they left in command my old college friend, Simon Bolivar Buckner. And the last exchange we had with General Buckner was one where he asked me for the terms of surrender, and I indicated that there would be nothing but but unconditional and immediate surrender, and I intended to move upon his works and respond to him. He found that most ungracious response, but he had no choice but to surrender. When we met, I immediately offered him money in advance for our... When I was in New York and had no way to get home, he took the money. He was a soldier, and he just lost an important battle. Finally, in February of 1864, Congress authorized the appointment of Lieutenant General of the Army, 3 stars. The last Lieutenant General of the Army had been General George Washington. I was quite honored when President Lincoln asked me to assume that job. And in March of 64, I came to New York, came to Washington to meet with the President, U.S. Grant, concerned on Illinois, and sent me to search a room because he immediately found the room on the second floor. It was a much better room. We unpacked and walked down to the White House, and knocked on the front door, and it turned out the president was holding a reception that night, and I walked in, and the man at the door told me to go down the hall and just walk into the room, and the room was full of people. President didn't know we'd never met, but he recognized me, and he called me over and shook my hand and introduced me to people. And what people wanted to shake my hand. Well, the president and I probably 8 inches different in height. And so we had to stand on a sofa next to him. And that's the way I shook hands for the next 2 hours. But the real business of the war was in May of 64, to finally take the fight to the Confederates in the East. And they finally destroyed the Confederate Army. I developed a plan where we had a 5-way coordinated attack under the most important positions from the Shermans, moving from Chattanooga to take Atlanta, which we did. We eventually engaged General Lee for a period of about 30 to 35 days, continuous fighting until the siege of Petersburg started. Finally, the scene was over, and General Lee and I met for the second time in April at Appomattox Court House. He didn't remember that we had met before. He didn't remember my case. I told him about our meeting. I only saw General Lee one time after that. After the war, I was given another star, and stayed commander of the army, but there were a number of problems with President Johnson, and particularly problems with Reconstruction. I think a lot of people think that the war ended on April 9, 1865, when General Lee surrendered. And even when the last of the army finally surrendered and disbanded, violence didn't stop at the town. And as violence continued, it became necessary to send more and more United States troops to states in the South. And it became apparent that this was going to be a very serious problem. In 1868, there was a common assumption that I would be nominated for President of the United States by the Republican Party, and I was. At the end of the nominating process, I sent a message. He didn't address the convention, which I was very glad. I sent a message to the delegates, and at the end of the message, I closed with, "Let us have peace." To me, that was the most important thing that the country wanted. And quite frankly, I did not believe that the violence in the South was going to be put down without a reintroduction of hostilities. America was simply not ready for it at that point. So There are a lot of people who criticize my presidency, who have suggested that it was not successful, and there were some problems, none of which were of my making, or at least I pretend that, but I thought several things that happened during my administration. We passed the 15th Amendment to the Constitution. We established the 30th National Park. We passed the first Civil Service Bill. And the Transcontinental Railroad was finished. After two terms of president, Julia and I still wanted to travel. We took off on a trip around the world. It took us 2.5 years to go around the world. And we went to all the regular places. We went to Europe and England and met the crown heads of Europe. But then we went to Egypt and we went east from there. We went to India. We didn't get to China. We made it to Japan. And I wanted to go to Australia, but there was no way to get to Australia at that point from Japan. So we came back home after 2.5 years and were prepared to settle into the life of a retired president and general. So many people would ask me to write my memoir, including Senator Clemens, who had become a good friend of mine, but I continuously declined. I just didn't feel, I felt that he had not written about the war, that it was not necessary for me to add something else to it. My son and Buck have gotten into an investment firm called Grant and Ward, and Buck is junior, he was S. Grant Jr. Buck has worked with this, Ferdinand Ward, who is the Wizard of Wall Street. He could give Ferdinand Ward money, and he would return even more to you on a regular basis. Everyone knew that the grant, the real reason the firm got started was because of the grant. And I came in for a few hours a day. I signed papers. I can't but confess I did not, and still do not understand finances. But I would sign the papers and go about my business trusting Buck and Mr. Ward to run the everyday business of the firm. One day Buck came to me in May of 1884 and said, the money was gone. All that. Millions of dollars that people had invested. He was trusted because of my name. And it turns out that Mr. Ward was a trick. Mr. Ward had taken off with the money. What money was left? The money he hadn't already lost. And everybody that invested in the firm, including me, was broke. I went home that night and I did not even have enough money to buy dinner. We had no money. Now, several very generous friends offered to lend us money. And one of the wonderful things that happened is many of my soldiers would send me $5 and just say, keep it general and do with it what you need. Samuel Clemens came back to me at that point and said, if you'll write your memoirs, I will get you the largest advance ever paid for a work written in the United States. And at that point, I had no choice. I had to do it for my family. In fact, as we agreed, and it was a peach, and I picked up a piece, and I took a bite of the piece, and it felt like someone had poured molten lead down my throat. The pain was so intense that my knees went out. Dr. Sue told me that I had tongue cancer. I was in New York City. I had access to the finest doctors in the world. In fact, one of them took my study and what he knew of my case to the leading cancer expert in the country without telling him who it was. And he looked at it and he said, this man will be dead in 3 months. I couldn't die until I finished my memoir. It was the only way that Julia and the kids would have anything to live on after I was gone. I had sell all of my war souvenirs. We had several houses. We had a house in Philadelphia. We had a house in New Jersey. We had a house in New York City. We sold the road. But through the help of friends and prayer, I began writing my memoir. The pain got worse. By the end, I couldn't speak. I would pass notes to my doctor. It's impossible to take pain medicine because it clouded my head and I had to write and finish the memoir. It would seem that man's destiny in this world is quite as much a mystery as it is likely to be in the next. I never thought of acquiring the rank of profession for which I was educated, and yet it came to me higher than any grade of general before me. I certainly had no ambition or taste for political life. I was vice president of the United States. If anyone had suggested the idea of my becoming an author, they frequently did. I was not sure if they were making sport of me or not. And now I've written a book, which is a hand to the manufacturer. The book was sold by subscription. And the soldiers would go door to door and sell it to their neighbors. There was a $1 volume, a $1 set, a $2 volume, and the lunch set was $3 in the volume. Some of the soldiers, the old soldiers, would come and I would have them. Not the regular, they would just stand at attention. Of course, silence was needed. I finished the book and sent it off to the editor a week before I died. I asked him to keep these notes very private, lest in response to my medical condition or the treatment of my disease, I become an authority in that field. I already have too many trades to be proficient in any. I see a time, perhaps not in my lifetime, but soon, when Confederates and the Union will be reunited, when we will be brothers again. Let us have
number 8. Fred, he was old enough by this time to help you research things.
Yes, Fred graduated from the military academy by
yes.
this point and was actually in the Army. So he was very great help, and we had a lot of cooperation from Washington as well. So.
If I may, one more question.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned the time during the Mexican War when you had to ride your horse across that field of fire.
Yes, sir.
And then you had to ride back again. And you wrote it in a very dry form. But when I'm looking at the scene, and I'm seeing an exciting bit. Now, was there not another incident in which you hauled a small gun up into a church steeple?
The mountain howitzer. And
yeah.
we were called upon in battle. It was outside the city of Mexico.
Yeah.
And we went to a church. The priest didn't want to let us in, but
that's
we suggested
right.
it would be a good idea for him to let us in. And we disassembled the gun and hauled it up by rope to the steeple of the church from which we could fire on the enemy. And we fired on the enemy and managed to relieve the fire that they were putting on our enemy.
Would you be surprised today to realize that your memoirs are considered an American classic?
I am honored by that. I don't deal with being honored very well. It's not in my nature to do that sort of thing or to like the kind of dancer, but I'm very proud of the fact that they are. So thank you for that. Yes, sir.
If you had been in command of the Army Department, and Jerry Reed was in Gettysburg, what would you have done on the fourth day?
General Reed was a very good general. He and I served together in tents next to one another in the last year and a half of the war, or the last year of the war, out in the field. And I know him to be a very good general. Remember that he had only taken over the Army of the Potomac 3 or 4 days before the Battle of Gettysburg. Once it was completed, close on the fourth day, the day that we took Gettysburg, they didn't really know what, they didn't even know if there was going to be another attack. I will tell you that trying to organize pursuit, as I mean, a lot of people have urged that he should have done that, is very difficult even when you know your army, when you know the units in your army and the commanders, and you know the personnel. At this point, determining how many men he had lost during that battle was impossible by July 4th or 5th. So, I am very reluctant to suggest that a competent general should have acted in another way because I wasn't there, and I know him to be good at his job, so I think that he probably acted appropriately in that case. And I was busy elsewhere. I was busy 800 miles away. Yes,
sir. Mr. Retreating in a great rainstorm, so you instead of the
rainstorms seem to occur quite often after large battles. There was a rainstorm the night between the two battles at Shiloh, and then there was a battle after that, a rainstorm after that. Now, there had also been rain for many days before that, so that might have been the season, but I've always been curious about the fact that there are often heavy rainstorms after heavy battles. I don't know if that has something to do with the atmosphere. Yes, sir?
What you were with him when you were sitting on the wall ordering a big order down, the most of the
equivalent of stick. I just whittled a stick till it was gone, and then I got another stick. fingers were gone. I also smoked 23 cigarettes back there, cigars back there. Yes, sir?
You know, I'd like to ask you about a meeting that you had with Secretary Stanton right down the street from the communication. I granted that on that occasion, he gave you the power to decide whether to keep General Rosecrans as his man or whether to replace him with Pat Thomas. First of all, is that true? As it is, if you gave him that much discretion, if it is true, then how did you decide to stay in the commission?
Well, actually, General Rosecrans stayed in command until the battle of Chickamauga, until the leader in command of that battle. It was really General Thomas' performance at that battle that took him back into the, brought him into the vanguard of command. General Thomas and I had some disagreements. General Thomas, as I said with General Meade, was what I think was a very brave and very competent general, but he had a bad case of the slow. And it was, particularly in the Battle of Nashville, but it was my belief that it was very difficult to get General Thomas to move as quickly as I liked him. I liked him to move. So, General Stanton and I did get along well, although the first time we met, we're not on a train, I think maybe it was in Ohio. And he came up to one of the other men in my command and said, "General Grant, I know you anywhere." He shook his hand and pointed out that he was not General Grant. That was when I had
two stars. Yes, sir. Grant Palmer is pretty popular in St. Louis for historical type. It's not too far from the building. Have you ever visited it?
Yes. We actually got a tour of Hart's Scramble inside. We don't normally get to go inside Hart's Scramble. They're just finishing up the next couple of weeks there. My birthday, they have a thing at the National Historic Site, which is actually Colonel Dent's property there, which is right beside Grant's farm. And as far as Galena, yes, one night my wife and I stayed in what was General Grant's campaign headquarters in 1868. But quite frankly, General Grant's connection with Galena, I think, is more important to Galena than it was to him. Julia was, when we moved there, I was a store clerk. Julia had fancied herself a daughter of a southern planter and slave owner. And I think it was kind of a come down that she wasn't appreciated in Galena's society. We were only there a few months, and by the time we came back after the war, Galena was a little too small for us by that point, and Julia was not interested in staying there. Yes, sir?
Next month, a fellow was trying to restore blue water as esteem. Mm-hmm. At the end of your memoirs, you kind of take back to your higher thought.
Yeah.
What do you think about the water?
Well, obviously, I wasn't very happy with him at Shiloh, and I wasn't very happy with him when I started writing my memoir. But I was given a number of things from his wife and from other military records that suggested that I had been a little hard on him. So, General Wallace was still, I don't think, destined for the upper level of command in the Army, and I'm glad he had a very successful writing career. But I will say, as I said in my memoir, that he wasn't quite as bad as I think.
Did Julia teach you?
No, Julia lived 17 years. Yeah, 04, I think. I can't remember because I've been dead. I died in 1885. But I think she lived till 04, 06, something like that. Yeah, he was there. Yeah. Yes, sir.
don't remember your funeral procession, but my grandfather did. And he cut a picture that had been drawn about your funeral procession and all that sort of thing. And I was impressed by it years ago and ended up taking it to Galena. And they honored me by giving me some money for it.
Wow. Congratulations. They had funerals for me all over the country. Healdsburg, Illinois, Carl Sandburg, and his memoir writes about going to, one of the first things he remembers is going to General Grant's funeral in Galesburg. And of course, General Grant wasn't there, but they had huge parades in towns all over the country for him. Again, stepping out of it for a minute, but it's one of the things that I find so fascinating about Brandon, and one of the reasons I like doing this, is because he was, I think, the most popular or admired American living in the 19th century.
Yes.
Lincoln, of course, his reputation was after he died, and all it takes is a visit to Springfield to see how vilified he was. Grant was even respected in the South. That Sherman was hated. Grant was respected in the South as a warrior. And yet, in fact, I'm a member of the U.S. Grant Association. We have meetings every year. And we had a guy talk about the destruction of Grant's reputation. And one of those little facts that's interesting to me is that until the First World War, Grant's tomb was the most visited site in the United States. And that the First World War is important because by then, the soldiers were all dead. By the 20s, I mean, there were still some left, but most of the veterans were dead and they were not coming anymore. But in the 1930s, there was a head of the American Historical Society, the professional academic organization, supervisor of historians. And he was a virulent racist. And if you read some of the things, and you say, I can't believe that an academic wrote these things in the 1930s. But he spat a lot of his vitriol at Grant, and a lot of the things that happened, particularly in Reconstruction. And then, of course, the drinking is always, I think, way overblown. And the other problem is, I always tell people, if you're general in the United States Army or a president of the United States, those are the most political jobs you can have, and anybody that wants to is going to take shots at you, so that can always happen to you. So. Yes, sir.
How were you treated when, after president, you didn't have a job, so you went on the, you and Julia went on the grand tour? How did they treat you in the other countries?
Treated me like royalty. I was everywhere. I was entertained by the heads of state. There were crowds. I had no idea there were crowds of ordinary people that would meet me and cheer me if I would go through the streets of these towns. It was these ancient cities. I had no idea that they even knew who I was. And then when we came back, we landed in San Francisco and took the train east, and the newspapers would announce every day where we were going to be, and there would be crowds meeting us. There was serious talk of nominating me again in 1880 for president. I declined to get involved in that because people were suspicious that I might have taken a great offer.
Was it Julia who had her hand in your not being in Ford's Theater that night because she didn't like Mary Lincoln?
Julia and Mrs. Lincoln had had an incident at Richmond just a few days before that. And Mrs. Lincoln had accused Julia of flirting with her husband.
Right.
And now, my Julia, whom I love dearly, I explained to you, had one crossed eye. And Julia was also horizontally gifted. And she was a wonderful lady. She was very charming, but I never knew Julia to flirt with anyone or to have someone return that flirting if that had been the case. But when they asked us, Julia was actually already away. She had left town earlier, before April 14th. So she wasn't there. I could have gone, but I was going to meet her. That was, she had already taken the kids, and they were going to New Jersey. So.
And that's why we never see a full face picture of Julia.
That's right. There's one full face left. There's also a letter where she wrote me, and she had seen a surgeon about the possibility of correcting the clot in her eye. And I wrote her, and I said, "No, that's what I fell in love with. That's the girl I fell in love with. I wouldn't want you to correct it."
Well done. Well done.
There's one of the great love stories of the 19th century. Yes, sir.
Yeah. You said you met Marjorie Lee one time.
I came to the White House after I was president. He was fundraising for then Washington College, soon to be Washington League. And he arrived, and I greeted him and asked how he got there. And he said he was taking the train in from somewhere. I joked that a few years ago, we were trying to blow up that